Hello and welcome to The Curator on Monaco Radio with me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. In the next 60 minutes, I will bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from the past week. And talking about this week, we speak with Russia's opposition politician Vladimir Milov.
There is a significant movement that was ignited by Navalny, and that will go on, and this is our best hope at the moment.
Plus, can we teach people how to be funny?
I talked to a neuroscientist at the very, very beginning of doing this, and I said, I'm trying to explain what comedy is. And he just went, oh, let me tell you, are you going to say it's like stage magic or music? And I went, yes. And he went, of course it is.
All that and much more in the next hour, here on The Curator, with me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. We start The Curator in Russia, where the death of opposition leader Alexei Navalny, along with Sunday's election, has cemented Vladimir Putin's position as the country's leader for the foreseeable future. The question now becomes what next for those who still dare to oppose him both inside and outside of Russia. We spoke with Vladimir Milov, a Russian opposition politician, economist, and energy expert who formerly served as economic advisor to the late opposition activist Alexei Navalny.
Of course, his death is having a devastating impact because it's a very rare occurrence in Russian totalitarian politics that a popular democratic leader emerges who continues to very much influence the situation after being poisoned, jailed, and now even after he is dead. So we didn't have many leaders like that who really ignited millions of people for fight for freedom and democracy in Russia. So that's a devastating loss, obviously. But I think Navalny's main legacy is that he managed to create a nationwide movement which will endure, which will survive his death. And as a matter of fact, we have been continuing working for the past 3.5 years since he was poisoned and was no longer capable of participating in our daily activities. We only had some limited communication with him. So I think also it's pretty visible also from the outside world that there are really very many people in Russia who still believe and have faith in Russia's democratic future. They attended Navalny's funeral on Sunday. They had attended the opposition protest called Noon Against Putin. So there is a significant movement that was ignited by Navalny, and that will go on. And this is our best hope at the moment.
Tell us more about this sort of nationwide movement and how you see it at the moment. I mean, the fact that there were those who came out to protest, as you say, on Sunday. At this point, they are, especially if you are protesting in Russia, you really are essentially taking your life into your own hands, aren't you?
That's true. It's an enormous risk. And we now have, according to a Memorial NGO, which has a very conservative system of estimating the status of political prisoners, there are almost 700 political prisoners in Russia right now. That's about three times bigger than what we had in the past couple of decades in the Soviet Union under Brezhnev, Andropov, or Gorbachev. So the environment is pretty harsh, but I also have really very big feedback from people across Russia, and they are beginning to say that they're tired of being afraid. After all this 2 years of full-scale war against Ukraine and enormous repression, they say that they cannot afford themselves to just sit and do nothing. They want to go out and protest. And we saw that. I mean, the first months of 2024 had actually brought a lot of very interesting new developments, huge queues in support of presidential candidate Boris Nadezhdin, who campaigned on the platform of ending the war but was not allowed into the race. We saw huge turnout at Navalny's funeral and now significant turnout at the opposition rally on Sunday during the voting day. So you see, something is brewing here. People are, letting go of being afraid and coming out in big numbers. I have a sense that this protest movement will be growing and we will be finding other formats which will be a bit more secure personally for the people, but would still allow them to protest.
You mentioned the war in Ukraine there, and I did want to ask you about that generally. But first, I was curious what you have made of the sort of cross-border attacks from Ukraine into Russian territory that were also happening in the run-up to Russia's election on Sunday. Is that a real threat in some way to Vladimir Putin?
This is not a real threat, like it might topple his regime, but this is very painful, and attacks on Russian territory become routine. But listen, this is what we have been saying all along, even before Putin's full-scale invasion. Like, I myself really did not believe until the last moment that he would invade, because one of the reasons was that this way he was exposing Russian territory towards military attack for the first time since 1944. And as a matter of fact, this is what we are seeing right now. This actually demonstrates the whole insanity of Putin's decision to invade Ukraine. So that was fairly predictable. And we have been, through our broadcasting onto the Russian audience, explaining all the time that Russia does have vulnerabilities and people of Russia will indeed suffer because of Putin's aggression against Ukraine. Ukraine has a right to defend itself. So this is not an unpredictable development at all. And our message to the Russian people is consistent. We should end the war and pull out all of the Russian troops out of internationally recognized Ukrainian territory. That's the only way to end this whole thing. However, I would say along with other major factors like major difficulties within the economy and deteriorating living standards and harsh repressive environment, international isolation, these are the issues that will further spark negative public sentiment against Putin brick by brick. And this attacks on Russian territory will also have their own impact.
Well, how much does Vladimir Putin then essentially need success in Ukraine when you describe that sort of brick by brick? I mean, do you feel like Russians could eventually turn on Vladimir Putin if he loses the war or loses too many lives or at too much of an economic cost somewhere down the line?
Russian society in its majority is already sending a strong message to Putin that the war should end. That was visible in the past few months in opinion polling and even at Putin's press conference in December when he took questions from Russians. And even the Kremlin host said that they received a flurry of questions about the war, with the main one being when this whole thing would end. So there is a pretty strong anti-war sentiment in the Russian society. It's only been contained by repression. But question is for how long, because you see that these grapes of wrath are beginning to be surfacing already. It is not that Putin is under like immediate pressure, but concerns are mounting that public opinion might be a constraining factor. Along with sanctions, economy, losses on the battlefield, this might add significant pressure so that Putin at some point in time will reconsider. In terms of, you know, the war and public opinion, nothing short of establishing control of Kyiv and major part of Ukrainian territory will be able to be sold as success. Some advances in Donetsk region and Zaporizhia region, the Russian public just doesn't buy it. There is this mounting question, what was this whole thing for? To incorporate some districts of Kherson and Zaporizhia into Russian territory, was it really worth it? So as a matter of fact, Putin does not have a realistic battlefield gain that he can use as a good sell to the Russian public. So anti-war sentiment will continue to multiply on this background.
And now, 2024 has already been dubbed the year of the election, with around 2 billion voters, or a quarter of the world's population, expected to be heading to the polls this year. But in the age of AI and online conspiracy theories, how does one win elections amid so much disinformation? Author and Monaco's U.S. politics correspondent Sasha Eisenberg has written a new book tackling exactly this issue. He sat down with Monaco's U.S. editor Chris Lord to discuss the lie detectives and how disinformation is already making itself felt in the run-up to November.
So I think everybody is on the lookout for how will the technological capabilities change the nature of disinformation this year. That could be the quantity of it. That could be the speed of disseminating, the scale, the scope. What's the role that AI is going to play? And particularly the new sophistication of deepfake video and audio. And we're seeing examples of this already. On the day of the New Hampshire primary, there was a fake Joe Biden who was recorded in an automated robocall going to New Hampshire voters saying, hey, the primary day has changed. Don't turn out and vote on Tuesday. It was a pretty good example of what somebody can do with, you know, off-the-shelf tools. But it's really important to realize that some of the most persistent and pernicious forms of online disinformation in the United States and elsewhere were text-based. The QAnon conspiracy in the United States, Donald Trump's election denial, which is not just a particular piece of online disinformation, but has become a sort of complete conspiracy theory that shapes how believers see basically every force in U.S. life. These were things that were not supported by persuasive fake videos. These were created by what is a pretty old school way of getting people to believe in conspiracy theories, which is you start telling them a story that they want to believe and have it accord just enough with reality and just enough with sort of playing to their inclinations and instincts, and they start to buy it, which is why we've had conspiracy theories in the world for centuries.
The character that emerges at the center of the book is called Jory Craig, and in a way, he is a political consultant, but he's been hired by campaigns all over the world to combat this disinformation, if you will, and it's certainly also the general doing it here in the United States. Tell me a bit about Jory Craig and sort of what he represents, if you like, in this battle against disinformation.
What happened after November 2016 was that this woman who had never before worked on a domestic American political campaign, she's from Illinois, but she had never worked in American politics, starts getting phone calls from people in Washington in prominent positions in the Democratic Party, at labor unions, tied to donors, who are saying, hey, we're trying to make sense of what just happened in this election. We're learning that there were these troll armies and bot farms that were attacking Hillary Clinton. This was all totally foreign to people in American politics. They knew a hell of a lot about every voter in the United States. They had all these ways of experimenting to measure what was effective and predict what would move certain voters. And now these political professionals, in the wake of the 2016 election, were having to confront the reality that there were all sorts of political communicators who had the ability to reach American voters and potentially sway them, whose objectives were not always clear. Some of the people who were engaging in, who were creating fake accounts on Facebook to spread news were not doing because they wanted to elect Donald Trump. They wanted to make money off of Facebook ad revenue. They wanted to have fun or create mischief. And Jory Craig became the person who explained to them how to think about all this. And that was because in these countries where she had worked on four or five different continents, a lot of the things that were new to American politicos were old hat, unremarkable.
People didn't necessarily call them disinformation, but, you know.
Here in America and in the West, were we a little bit naive to this, really? We were sort of attached to an old, safe world where that didn't happen.
Yes, and, you know, some of that is distinctive to the U.S., I think, in that so much of the American political model was tied up in we raise lots of money and we communicate over centralized channels. And the campaign is being run foremost by these sort of centralized political communicators. That model was disintegrating in 2016 in the US. And it was the fact that Jory Craig had worked in places where those things were entirely unremarkable, made her this incredibly valuable guide to thinking about the practical questions that faced American political communicators. So she became the person that, you know, the first real counter disinformation operative in American politics, and has done more than anyone to shape the way that at least the Democratic Party and it and the American left think about some of these problems.
Your book is subtitled as a
playbook, a way of thinking about how to counter disinformation, how to
tackle it in this world of politics. Ironically, you know, Jory's sort of one of her main things that she ends up telling a lot of these politicos that you say she's sat down with is do nothing.
The worst case scenario is that you end up amplifying or promoting it. The algorithms that disseminate and promote content online respond to engagement. Most of the examples we see, and that frankly are often surfaced now by kind of disinformation reporters in the media who are incentivized to find the most outrageous things that are circulating somewhere online and service them are finding things that are being followed by improbably small audiences. And so the challenge that people like Jory Craig have is convincing decision makers in campaigns, this could be elected officials, candidates, how to distinguish between the stuff that's just a nuisance and the stuff that's a real problem. In the US this year, I think the most underappreciated frontier in disinformation is there's increasing use of apps like WhatsApp, especially among immigrant communities in the US, Asian American, Latino immigrant communities. Getting visibility into them from campaigns and political communicators is really difficult. The challenge is that a lot of the institutions which once mediated truth, certainly in the United States, but I think versions of this are true in throughout the world, are weaker than they were. The deep disinformation problem that we face is, why are people so willing to accept lies online and focus more on who's welcoming them than who's putting them out?
We're back here with the curator, with me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Can being funny be taught? Joe Morris, who is a funny guy indeed, thinks so, up to a point. His new book is a distillation of what he has learned as a professional comedy writer. It's called Be Funny or Die, How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. We spoke to Joe at Midori House earlier, and we began by asking whether he would be at all nervous about giving up the tricks of his trade.
I think anyone who writes comedy, not necessarily a performer, but a writer of comedy or a fixer of comedy, which is what I am, you sort of have to know how to do it. I think I found it frustrating that people kept saying, there's no way of explaining it. And I thought, well, if there's no way of explaining it, what was I learning? Because, I mean, I'm a musician as well, and I just thought, it's the same as chords on a guitar, isn't it? There's a play in a day version of comedy that you could give people. And I couldn't believe no one had even tried to explain it before.
You draw that comparison a couple of times in the book between comedians and between musicians, and it got me thinking, in terms of what you were just saying, the play in a day idea, that I wonder if there is something similar with both, because it has always been my contention, having met a lot of musicians as well as a lot of writers, that you can probably teach anybody to play guitar up to a certain standard, but you can't teach everybody to be Richard Thompson. You've either got that or you haven't got it. Is the same true with comedy? Are some people just funnier?
Yeah, totally. I mean, obviously, that's the same thing with anything. The best example being, most people can probably play the bass, but not many people can play the bass well. I mean, that's a huge leap on. Mm-hmm. But the basics of it, the idea that it's inexplicable, the way that comedy has a sort of magic circle, a murta, about it, says, oh, this is impossible to describe. And I talked to a neuroscientist at the very, very beginning of doing this, and I said, I'm trying to explain what comedy is. And he just went, oh, let me tell you, are you going to say it's like stage magic or music? And I went, yes. And he went, of course it is. And as a neuroscientist, he said, it's a system of tricks, and the trick is to make people not see what you're doing. You're constantly palming coins and putting cards up your sleeve and things. You've got to surprise people, but they've also got to see what's coming. And it's, the tricks are so similar. As someone who learned the guitar, I'm not a great stage magician, but I can see, I've got friends who are, and the tricks are the same. You've got to make people look one way while you're doing something the other way. And it's really weird that we live in a world that has Penn and Teller showing you how tricks work, and we go, they're still magical. I still love going to magic shows, even though I know it's tricks. And I thought the same thing's true with comedy. You are doing a limited number of moves. There's 12 notes in the scale, but you can do an infinite number of tunes with it.
You described yourself earlier as a fixer of comedy, and again, this is something the book goes into, which may not occur to, well, most consumers of comedy, because, of course, we consume it as a finished product in the same way that we do a record. We don't see the rewrites and the tinkering and the arguments that went on behind the scenes. But how does that process usually work, or how has it worked in your experience? How does it happen when somebody brings an idea to a writer's table or whatever the arrangement is and asks the always dreaded question, is this anything? And the rest of you have to try and think, maybe, maybe not, there's something here. How do we get this up to the gate?
The thing that I love about, and I found this out quite recently, I've been doing comedy for ages, and then someone, I was talking to an improviser, I'm talking to Cariad Lloyd, who's a brilliant live improviser, she does Ostentatious and things. And she was describing her process, and I went, oh my God, that's the same as writing. And I just thought that what all writing is improv for shy people. And you don't have to do it in front of anybody, which is the weird thing is because you don't do it in front of anybody, sometimes you don't have an audience. So you have to build better instincts on what's going to work and not going to work because you don't get a laugh back. But you're improvising to the page. The moment you sit down on your own, you're improvising to the page. There's nothing there. You've got the germ of an idea. You've got to see where that idea goes. But if there's a bunch of you together, which often you're writing with a collaborator mm-hmm. or a producer or a script editor, or that at best there's a writer's room, you're just trying to make each other laugh. And that takes it back to what comedy is in the first place, which is what you do with your brothers and sisters or your friends at school. You're trying to get a giggle out of each other. You're trying to get that reaction, get that soothing, happy, joyful feeling. And you just keep tinkering with it. What you mustn't do, as improvisers always tell you, is say no. You've got to keep going, yeah, what about, and keep taking the... And anyone who's ever got into a rolling giggle with a mate, taking an idea further and further, knows what that feeling's like. And I think that's what's interesting about comedy as a science, is that people go, well, you can't analyse it. And I went, but you've sat with a friend and worked an idea up until you've been in hysterical giggles. That's what you're doing.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Hello, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco, back here with The Curator. UK author and journalist Helen Russell left her job in London as editor of Marie Claire and relocated to Jutland in Denmark with her husband in 2013. What initially set out to be a year-long trip quickly turned into a decade. Her freelance career had seen her work as Scandinavia correspondent for The Guardian and writing for publications such as The Observer, Stylist and Grazia, and published 6 books, including The Year of Living Danishly, Uncovering the Secrets of the World's Happiest Country, which became an international bestseller and was translated into 21 languages. Her latest book, How to Raise a Viking, uncovers the secrets to parenting the world's happiest children.
I was living and working in London for 12 years as a journalist. I had no intention of leaving. And then out of the blue on Wet Wednesday, my husband came home and told me he'd been offered this job in Denmark. And not Copenhagen, not the jazzy part that everyone's heard of, but rural Jutland. But Denmark had just been voted the happiest country in the world. And as a naturally nosy person, I became fascinated by this. So thought maybe this year experiment might work. But yes, prior to that, knew nothing about the Nordic countries, very much an indoor city girl, not outdoorsy at all. So yes, it was a complete switch, really, moving there.
And did your husband have any Viking connections?
No, not at all. No, both British, both pretty clueless in the ways of Nordic life, as well as parenting, as it turned out. But yes.
Yeah. So when you first got there, I mean, was that a bit discombobulating?
Well, the weather's terrible, for starters. You can't not notice that people are sort of rushing around trying to get indoors in winter because it's so cold and dark. But yes, as soon as I arrived, I noticed that people were different. They didn't quite look like us, not just because they were all strapping Vikings towering above me, but people walked more slowly. They took their time to stop and eat together. Babies were left to nap outside in their prams, even in the snow. And rush hour starts at around 3 because office hours are maybe 8 till 4, and they have this great work-life balance. So I noticed straight away that it was not at all like NW6 anymore.
And being in a very rural part, I mean, that must have been a big change for you too.
Yes, it was. I did not own Wellingtons. I had to be slowly kitted out. The Danes like to say there's no such thing as bad weather, just the wrong clothes. And I resisted for the longest time. But they all have what Stanford psychologists call the positive wintertime mindset. So they think, well, if you dress for it, you'll be fine. But I resisted for ever so long, and there was just no one around. I live in a town now, but when I first arrived, it was just me and a few owls. There was a bus stop once with a dog tied to it, but there was nobody around, and no internationals. I didn't speak the language, had no friends, no family. So yeah, big culture shock.
You live in a town that you call the Pony Porn Town.
Yes.
Tell us why.
Well, the prominent local landmark of Vila in Jutland is a horse standing on its hind legs in full frontal glory, surrounded by cats with breasts. So we began referring to it affectionately as the Pawny Pony. And then that's sort of taken off. Now I get sent pictures by people who've gone on almost a pilgrimage there to take a picture of themselves with the Pawny Pony. So yeah, the Pawny Pony Town is now home.
Can I ask, is the pony a stallion?
He's a stallion, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Okay, on my wish list.
See you there.
The Year of Living Danishly. What a wonderful title for your first book. Tell us about the premise of that.
Well, as I say, I was just trying to go for a year. I didn't really want to relocate. So I said, well, I'll give it a year. We'll do it for a year. We'll see. And I thought, well, why does Denmark keep coming top of these happiness polls? And not just the one then, but all the way back to the 1970s, I thought there must be something different that Danes are doing. Is it something in the water? Is it Lego, beer, bacon? So I thought, well, I'm going to look at every area of Danish life to see what it was that they did differently and what I could take with me when I thought I would return back to London pretty soon. So I began investigating. And in London, we'd been trying to start a family for years. We'd had years of fertility treatment, but nothing seemed to be working. And then halfway through my year of living Danishly, I found out that I was suddenly pregnant and had a tricky pregnancy. So then the year slipped into two. This book came about. I was writing about Scandinavia for UK newspapers, and then it became a book. And then there was this sort of explosion of interest in the Nordic countries, I think, because people were looking for answers, looking for a different way of life. And I think the Nordic countries did and still do have quite a lot that they can teach us.
Mm, absolutely. And now, of course, your next book is all about having children in that country and how you bring them up to be happy. Let's talk a little bit about your second pregnancy, though, and IVF generally in not only Denmark, but you are talking generally about the Nordic countries.
Yes, there are fewer invasive treatments. There's less monitoring. It's kind of Viking, the approach. Somebody came at me when I was pregnant with an ear trumpet, which I wasn't expecting. I thought there maybe would be a scan of some kind, but apparently Peanut's horn worked just fine. But it's much more relaxed. You're allowed to carry on exercising as normal. I spoke to Norwegian mothers-to-be who said, oh no, I was skiing 6 months pregnant. Other than a few, you know, the general advice not to drink alcohol, not to smoke, it's pretty much business as usual. So yes, pregnancy is quite relaxed there. There's great parental leave, as we all read about in the Nordic countries.
And lots of help to get IVF.
There's lots of help, yes. So I think 10% of children are conceived with fertility treatment in Denmark. So it's just very normalised. And it means that the kind of family formations that can often mean that you're likely to be worse off or can attract stigma in this country are perfectly normal there. I think there's about 37 different types of family, the Danish government have noted. I have two friends right now having babies solo with donor sperm. It's just much more normalised. So your bog standard fertility treatment and IVF, it's now actually, it's free for your first child and it's now free for your second child as well. It wasn't when I was there, but it was still a lot cheaper than it would have been had I been doing IVF in London.
And of course, you now have twins.
I now have twins. Surprise. Twins, yes. So from going from no children, then 3 years later, suddenly three was quite a shock.
Now, there's a whole chapter on donors. I was kind of sitting there absolutely rapt and my partner came in and he said, what are you reading about? I said, oh, Danish sperm. So tell us about Danish sperm.
Well, I can see why you're rapt. Yes. So Denmark is sort of this, it's another major export, the one they don't talk about. We all talk about Lego and beer and bacon. But yes, sperm. Denmark sends its sperm to 100 countries worldwide. Donations to the UK have been increasing year on year. They now account for 30% of all new imported sperm in the UK. So they're calling it almost like the gentle Viking invasion. It's big there. It's more affordable. There's no stigma attached for the donors. So they're not motivated by money. They don't get paid very much, maybe about 50 quid for a donation. But there's more of a culture of altruism and volunteering and donating of all kinds. So it's more normalised. And it's something that people don't snigger about. I still do, obviously, because I'm British. But Danes don't tend to snigger about it. So it's quite normal. You're allowed to be an anonymous donor in Denmark as well. So that helps. I think more donors are likely to come forward and be happy to be involved. But yeah, it's a big industry in Denmark.
And talking about happiness, this week also marked International Happiness Day. As usual, the day has been graced by the release of the annual World Happiness Report. And as usual as well, at least for the seventh year running, it declared that the happiest of all the world's nations is Finland. So we've asked Finland's ambassador to the United Kingdom, Jukka Siukkasaari, about what does that mean?
It's good to talk about happiness and the strong points of the Finnish society. So it is part of the job. And when the agenda is negative, the work is more pleasant.
How do the Finns, who are, of course, a famously restrained and taciturn people, celebrate being named the happiest people on earth? Do you smile slightly, stand somewhat closer together than normal? What is the protocol?
Very good question. I presume that there would be more smiles on the people's faces than on average day in Finland. After all, it's also spring approaching and then more sunshine and less gray surroundings. But of course, as you said, this is becoming a habit. So Finns were expecting to be number one. And of course, being the semi-pessimistic people we are afraid of losing the first position. So now we'll concentrate on defending what we have gained.
Well, this is something I am genuinely starting to wonder about. Would it be a kind of hideous downward spiral if Finland ever got knocked off top spot? Because you would then be unhappy about that, which would mean the following year you were even less happy. And where would it end?
I think we would be even more determined to get it back the following year. So I don't think that logic is true. But to be honest, it is, of course, great pleasure to have this position again. And the discussion we had in Finland in the early years, which was pretty much centered around that it must be wrongly measured, has died out. So we have accepted the position as the happiest nation in the world.
Well, the question that then arises for the seventh year running is what actually is your secret? Is there one particular thing that it strikes you that Finns are this supernaturally happy about?
I don't think there is a magic potion or medicine that would explain the whole with one word or one sentence. I think it's a combination of many things. We talk about the infrastructure that enables happiness. So the society has over the decades and centuries evolved in a way that allows individuals to be happy or content in their everyday lives. And it's a combination of many things. Equality is one thing, of course. Trust in institutions, but also trust between citizens, closeness to nature, ability to interact not only with fellow human beings, but also the larger ecosystem and the world around us.
There's a couple of things there I did want to pick up on, particularly that aspect of trust in institutions, which I know is by global standards very high in Finland, and that's largely, as I've been able to understand it, with good reason, in that the institutions and the infrastructure and most things in Finland work. Is it actually that simple, that if you build people a functional state, then that will increase the general happiness?
Well, of course, it's easy to say that you build a state like that, but it's not easier said than done. So you have to have certain elements in place. I think one thing that we benefit from is that the public service or being a civil servant is still relatively valued as a career choice in Finland. So teachers, for example, who are employed by the municipalities, that profession is a very sought after profession. People want to become teachers. And it's also valued so in the society. And that brings then with it the willingness sort of to be part of the machinery, low levels of corruption. So that's another explaining factor. But how do you build that from scratch, or when you start with a very low level trust in institutions, is a very difficult question. And I don't have an answer to that.
That relative sense of equality you mention as well, is that important? The idea that I guess there's not really anybody to resent?
Yes, in a way, I would say that. I think it begins at birth already. So every Finnish child has the same opportunities to succeed in life. A free education system or a non-payment education system, in the sense that it's paid from the taxpayers' pockets, is one part of that. But then also the equality between gender. And an interesting fact which I learned when I was studying the materials yesterday and today is that actually Finnish fathers spend more time with their children than any other developed nation. So that might be a lesson for my fellow fathers listening to you here, that think about that and think about what the importance of the family as a unit and both parents taking responsibility of their children has on happiness.
And just finally, Ambassador, if we think about this from your personal perspective, when you think about the country you come from and indeed the country you represent in the world, what is it about Finland that makes you especially happy to be a Finn?
I'm extremely happy about the fact that Finns are, in general, forward-looking. They invest in their future and in their children's future. We also take our national security very seriously. And that has been shown, of course, with the turbulent times that we are now witnessing with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So the nation sort of has a very strong sense of togetherness and also the will to defend the country if need be.
And we're back here with the curator. Time now for this week's Food Neighborhoods, where we join Theo Rando, chef patron of Theo Rando at the Intercontinental, as he takes us on a tour of Regent's Park Road in the Primrose Hill area of London.
Hello, my name's Theo Randall. I'm chef patron of Theo Randall at the Intercontinental. We are going to Primrose Hill. I've been living in Primrose Hill since 2001, and Regent's Park Road is a food haven. I chose Regent's Park Road because I take my dog. I've got a lovely Labrador. I take her for a walk every morning. And I'm a bit of a creature of habit. So I kind of go down Regent's Park Road and on various days go to some of the foodie places. The best place to get my morning coffee would be a little coffee shop called the Little One Coffee Shop, which is right at the end of Regent's Park Road. And they sell the most fantastic coffee. And they also do a really, really good pancake. And when I say pancake, I mean savoury pancake. So my favourite is their sort of mushroom and ham one, which is apps and cheese, obviously, which is absolutely delicious. The best place for brunch, and I think it's one of the best places in London, actually, is called Greenbury Cafe. It's been there for quite some time, and they do the best brunch. I mean, they do. My favourite dish is kedgeree. So they do a wonderful kedgeree. I always get an extra poached egg on top and a side of crispy chorizo. Absolutely heaven, that salty chorizo, smoky salty chorizo with haddock and rice with turmeric. Delicious, with that soft poached egg on top. So now we're walking to what I think is probably, I'm a bit biased, but I think is the best Italian deli in London, and it's called Primo Provisions, and it's on Regent's Park Road. It's a very simple little Italian shop run by a lovely couple. They're from Calabria. And you walk into the shop, and on the right-hand side, you see the most incredible selection of Italian cheeses and salumi, amazing sausages, wonderful antipasti like artichokes, beautiful burrata, mozzarella, that kind of thing. They have an incredible selection of Italian wines. I mean, really amazing. Some fantastic Italian wines there. And then probably one of the best selections of dried pasta you'll see anywhere. But every imaginable shape and all different brands. But it's a lovely shop. I love it. It's somewhere where I go and buy probably some burrata, buy some prosciutto di Parma or some salami, and take it home for a nice lunch. They have fabulous olive oil too. They will celebrate the new season's olive oil. So they're very foodie without even being foodie. It's just kind of natural to them. Coming from Calabria, they've got a real sense of quality of ingredients. And they sell nduja, the proper nduja, in the big pieces, which is always amazing. If you ever want to get an nduja, that's the best place to buy it, because obviously it comes from Calabria. It's a real favourite of mine. I go there a lot. Lunch out for me is a sort of family place, which is called Lamonia, which is a Greek restaurant on the corner. It's been there for absolutely donkey's years, and we always go there for any kind of family celebration. They have these amazing big tables. They've got a private room upstairs. It's just good old quality Greek food. My favourite thing is a Greek salad with a whole grilled gilt head sea bream. I mean, you get it on the bone, half a lemon. The most delicious chips. I mean, they make their own chips. Everything's made there. It's wonderful. And it's kind of really good value for money. You know, whenever I get the bill, I'm always thinking, my God, have they missed something? Because it is always incredible value for money. You're never disappointed there. The place has got an incredible atmosphere. All the waiting staff have been there since day one. We've been going there since the kids were pretty much tiny, and they're big now. So, yeah, we've been going there a long time. Lovely place. A good snack, I would probably go somewhere like, there's a great shop that sells bread and pastries, and that's called Ronnie's. They sell the best bread. They sell the most amazing bread, which is a four-grain sourdough bread. That's used at home a lot for toast. My daughter and I are absolutely obsessed by Marmite, so a little snack at our house tends to be a couple of slices of that bread toasted, but it has to be toasted right, because if you don't get it, you know, just the right amount of toasting colour on it, it doesn't taste as good. Lots and lots of butter and loads of Marmite. And so I'll always get the bread from there. Or if I just want to fancy a little piece of cake, I might get a piece of cake and sit outside with the coffee. My daughter loves getting a smoothie every morning. We'll go to the same shop called Yeoman's. It's a greengrocer. It's also a florist. And again, it's been there for a very, very long time, but they have lovely vegetables. They always have, you know, English asparagus. They have amazing mushrooms like girolles. Occasionally have some porcini, that kind of thing. And they do wonderful juices. So she always gets a juice every morning. She goes to get the juice. I go to get the bread. And it's been there forever. And it's a lovely place. And, you know, you can get really great flowers and get some veg. I mean, they're wonderful fruit. They have these huge, big boxes of Amalfi lemons with leaves on outside. And they always have blood oranges. And I always get Seville oranges there when I make marmalade. So it's, yeah, it's a good place. There's lots of great pubs. There's a nice pub right on the corner, which has got tables outside. So it's lovely sitting out there in the summer. And they have really good real ale on pump, which is essential, really. I mean, if you want a really good pint, that's the best place to go. Alternatively, if we're going to be at home, there's a very nice wine shop called Bottle Apostle on the corner of Regent's Park Road. I'm sticking to Regent's Park Road. There's nowhere else I need to go. I mean, it is the most brilliant place for everything. And they have an incredible selection of wines in all categories. And also their knowledge is superb. I mean, the guy who runs a shop, he just knows everything. And I'll go in there and it's almost like a lesson in wine. So it's always inspiration going there. So I'll probably maybe get a bottle of wine and take it home, and maybe we'll have a drink in the garden. But a pint at the Queen's is pretty hard to beat. Well, dinner, the best restaurant in Regent's Park Road is Odette's restaurant. It's a fantastic restaurant. It's been there for a long time. It's just really sophisticated in the sense of the food. It's not complicated, but it's just really great quality food. For a special occasion, I'd go there. If it was a big family celebration, I'd go probably to Limonia. But what I tend to do as a chef, and it's my day off, I'm not working, I love to cook. It sounds a bit odd. People say, why do you want to cook on your day off? So I absolutely love cooking, you know, because when you're a chef, you're always under pressure. You're cooking, you're doing all these things in the restaurant, in the kitchen. But actually, sometimes cooking at home is one of the nicest things to do, because you can relax, you can let go, you can try things. And so what I tend to do is I tend to go to a fish shop called La Petite Poissonnière, which is not on Regent's Park Road, but it's just around the corner. And it's a fantastic fish shop. The owner is French, his wife is Japanese. They have a really incredible selection of sushi and amazing little Japanese snacks and little tasty things. But they have really good fish. One thing that they always have is clams. They have amazing palourdes. They have wonderful lobster. They have fantastic sea bass. All the kind of things I love to cook. So what I'll probably do is I'll probably go there, get a kilo of clams, buy a pack of spaghetti from Primo Provisions, and go home and make a spaghetti alla vongole, which is one of my favourite things to eat in the world. I think everyone loves spaghetti vongole. If I was going to go on Primrose, I'll keep it kind of simple. I always think these sort of over-elaborate picnics are just too much. But one thing I love, always love, and that's a panzanella, so Tuscan bread salad. So basically a lovely bit of sourdough bread that's a little bit old, put it in the oven for 5 minutes just to get it nice and crispy. Make some nice dressing with tomatoes, some grilled peppers. Anchovy is essential, with a bit of garlic vinegar. Crush that in a pestle and mortar, add some olive oil, lots of basil, and just mix it all together. It's no looker, but it tastes amazing because the bread just absorbs all that lovely tomato and all the olive oil. And it's a wonderful thing. Or probably just take a really great sandwich. I mean, you know, a really good sandwich and a cold beer is always nice. What would be in my sandwich? Probably my favourite sandwich is probably just some really nice ham that's just sort of poached ham, you know, not smoked or anything, just simple ham with lots of butter. I mean, a lot of butter. And then a huge amount of English, Coleman's English mustard. I don't think you can really beat that as a sandwich, because it's just got everything. The bread, you know, you don't want the bread to be too soft. You want it to be got a bit of texture. The butter should be enough butter to really make you realise you're eating a lot of butter. And then that kick of English mustard should just make you sort of your nose tingle. And that sort of sweetness of the ham. I'm actually feeling really hungry now.
And now a highlight of my show, The Stack, where I speak with editors of different magazines. This time I spoke to Michael Levy. He's the editor of the relaunched Summit Journal, a climbing magazine that has returned after 27 years.
I used to work for a couple other climbing magazines, left a few years ago, but I'd always known about Summit. It was founded in 1955 by these two women, Jean Crenshaw and Helen Kilness, and it was the first monthly climbing magazine in America, and it was, you know, the climbing magazine for a couple decades, and then a couple other magazines came in, and it disappeared in 1996. The old magazine had all these amazing, cool old covers with really kind of avant-garde and chic design, and so I just loved the story and the imagery, and I was like, well, I can't exist for a new era. And so the hardest part was figuring out how to who owned it still, but I kind of just started exploring, poking around, seeing what would be possible, and now yeah, it's back.
And it's nice that you're paying tribute, because, you know, it's been such a special title with such an amazing history. And by the way, I need to mention this as well. You mentioned about the chic covers and very lovely design. You can actually buy some prints from your website, right?
Yes, exactly. We offer fine prints of some of the vintage covers, more going up soon. And we'll soon be having this really cool kind of interactive cover archive online. So you can kind of scroll through all the old covers, see who designed them or took the photos, what was in the issue a little bit. Because yeah, I'm definitely, the new Summit is a magazine for new era, but it's fully informed by the original title.
Well, I have, you know, the new issue right in front of me, issue 320, spring 2024. I have to say, you know, talking about covers, it does not disappoint. But I think one of the things about this new version of Summit Journal, that it's still very much a focus on print, right? I know there are other climbing magazines out there with gears, which is lovely, but I think Summit Journal has a different purpose in that sense, right?
Totally. So Summit Journal is print only. So any of the articles and features inside, they don't go online. So it's, you know, the idea is that we really believe in print, and that a long form story, you're going to have a better experience really sitting down with that and reading than staring at the screen. Not to say that there's not great journalism online, but in this modern media landscape, particularly in climbing and outdoor journalism, there's kind of just a focus on more and more and more content, 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 you know. And so taking a step back and slowing down and doing less, but doing it really, really well is the goal. I'm a nerd for long form journalism. So I love The New Yorker, The Atlantic, all that stuff. And I want to do that for climbing.
And for climbing, I mean, of course, you can say this about all magazines, but I think even more for a title like Summit Journal, the importance of photography. I mean, because the paper quality is excellent, the photography is excellent. It's really, it's quite special. I was reading the story about that I didn't even know exists actually in Ireland, about climbing some mountains in Ireland. I mean, the quality of photography is astounding. Tell us about the importance of photography for a title like yours.
Totally. It is of paramount importance. I mean, climbing, one of the things that's so cool about it is it has all sorts of drama just built into its very DNA, both in the stories, but also you look at a teeny woman or teeny guy way up there on a cliff or a mountain, and it's just, it's awe inspiring. And particularly with climbers traveling all over the world now, or cropping up in local places all over the world, and people being able to capture so much more with, you know, without having to have a multi-$1,000 setup. There's really phenomenal photography all over it. But the thing is then, right, I kind of think of it like Instagram's like drinking from a fire hose. Like, it's just a glut. And so really culling the, and being really intentional, curating what we want in that magazine, finding, you know, this place that you mentioned, the Ireland article. I'd never heard of it, but there's this great French photographer, Sam Bia. And he's got this eye, and this place is so spectacular. For anyone who's seen the movie The Banshees of Inisherin,
yes,
there's climbing on that island where it was filmed, and this guy Sam Bia went there with some climbers and were climbing on the sea cliffs, and it's breathtaking. You don't even need to read a word of the article, and it'll blow you away.
This picture here is quite special as well. I don't know if you can see from the screen.
So that what the picture is showing me is it's this full spread of this guy climbing on a sea cliff with this huge wave breaking behind him. And we have a version of that on the cover. But then when you see it in a full spread, it's just a pretty, I mean, AI couldn't come close.
Good. I'm going to use that quote, Michael. And the climbing community, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, I feel that is growing. I feel that there are more people interested. Perhaps they might not be as adventurous as some people featured in your pages, but there is kind of a desire for more climbing. You see, even popular culture, there's been films, documentaries about it. The interest is high, and that's why I think there's a space for a magazine like Summit Journal.
I think that's spot on. On the one hand, it's just been making more and more inroads into the mainstream for a number of years now, from Alex Honnold and Free Solo to Meru and Conrad Anker. And then obviously you have the proliferation of climbing gyms in the US and Europe and all over the world, really. But then on another front, outdoor climbing, which is what Summit is really focused on, so rock and ice and mountains, there are local communities all over the world that are really coming into their own. And Summit, as it always was back in the day, I'm really trying to take a global perspective. So even though it's a US-based magazine with perhaps a US focus, we have Ireland in there. I have, hopefully, coming in something, a Cuba climbing story, something in Japan. And, for example, a couple years ago, was in Malawi in southeastern Africa, and the climbing community there, it's young, but it's thriving. So it's definitely a sport that is, I think, having a moment, and people are really discovering it. So that's another reason that Summit just felt like a no-brainer. There aren't a lot of print offerings for the space, so.
And finally, here on the show, we sit down with Amanda Sharp and Matthew Zlotover, the founders of Freeze Art Fair, to find out about their culinary ventures and the intersection between art and food.
I mean, I think you have to understand that art is a solitary activity. Most artists work in their studios by themselves. It's not like theatre or film where you're with loads of people and you want to get away from them. When artists leave their studio, they need to be with people because they haven't had much contact. And so the talking goes on, you know, usually over food, for sure. And at art openings, when, you know, everyone works together to make an exhibition, the big celebration is the dinner after the opening. And, you know, we've been to a lot of those in our time, enjoyed a lot of those. But that's when everything, all the work that everyone's done over the months and years, you know, culminates in a nice dinner, which I've noticed doesn't necessarily happen in other art forms. So I think there is an element to that, yeah.
I mean, also drinking. I mean, there's a long history of artists congregating in bars. In
quite famously, yes.
And I remember, you know, years ago talking to an artist friend of mine and talking about Francis Ford Coppola and his kind of outreach into hospitality and the connection to film. And we were talking about the ICA in London as we were growing up in the 80s as feeling like this incredibly exotic, important space, because you could go to the bar, anyone could go to the bar, and you just didn't know who would be standing next to you and who you would talk to. And, you know, I met incredible artists as a student in the ICO bar. And, you know, that was a very exciting thing, the idea that you might be able to create a convening space again that was democratic and accessible for people.
Talkless has now been running for a couple of years. Have you found that it has become the convening place that you wanted it to become? You've obviously met and interacted with more artists than we can mention right now. But do you find that, is it a place for friends? I have to admit that I actually did go to Talkless during Freeze Week because I was so curious to see who would be at the tables. Yeah. And it's interesting, right? Where is the connection between your friendship group, the artist scene of London, and how much do you think it has become a place where during Freeze Week, you just have to book a table at because you never know who you're going to bump into?
I mean, every day there's someone from the art world or related kind of cultural field in there. Not everyone. And I think maybe when we started, we thought it would be everyone, but it's a big place and it's accessible to lots of people. And there's lots of academics who work nearby. There's lawyers who live nearby. So it's a mixture. But often you'll have like four or five tables of people who know each other who've worked with each other, who didn't know the other one was going to be there. And that's definitely what we were looking for, is a place where you could bump into interesting people who you hadn't arranged to meet, actually, but you were pleased to see. And there's a few places like that in London. We definitely wanted this to be on that list of places where happenstance would take place.
What about the art in the restaurant? Because that's the other side of the coin, right? Like, there are also plenty of restaurants around the world that have become almost like mini galleries in themselves. You know, you go to Kronenhalle and you're going to find some pretty incredible things on the walls. How do you create that from scratch in a way? Because a lot of these hallowed art restaurants around the world were frequented by people over the course of the decades, and they accumulated these treasures through frequentations. Whilst, you know, when you start from scratch and you want to make an art-leaning restaurant, how do you go about it and who do you get involved?
Well, actually, it was a real dilemma for us, how much art to have on the walls. I mean, one of the, you know, the most favourite art restaurants in London is St John's, that has nothing on the walls at all. And, you know, we've got lots of friends who are artists who, you know, how does it feel if a gallery does a dinner in the restaurant and it's other artists' work on the wall? And so it's sort of almost a big challenge for us to resolve how art would be in the restaurant, whether it's through asking artists to design napkins or getting friends to design the salt and pepper pots or asking an artist to make a work to go on a wall. And I think it's still slightly in development. Both of us, when we went away and really thought about artists we would like to invite to do something, came back with the same person, which was Wolfgang Tillmans. We both love his work. We followed it for decades. We both live with his work at home and love doing so. And he's so clever. You know, we went to him and asked if he might do something, and we thought he might come back with all kinds of different ideas, collages, you know, large-scale installations. But he came back with exactly the right image. I mean, just first conversation, bang, it was perfect. It's a picture of a swimming pool with vegetables around it in the sun. It just makes you think of summer, of relaxing, of being with friends, of having an amazing moment, of eating something delicious. It's even sexy, you know, it's everything you could want to convey in one image for a restaurant. And that sort of has pride of place at the end of the room. And then we wanted to have a different atmosphere in our bar room. So we thought about a restaurant in New York that was called Le Z that had posters from exhibitions all over its walls, and it changed to another restaurant and the posters had stayed up, and it just seemed like a fantastic idea. So we wrote to about 150 different friends and said, do you have a poster that you think looks great? Yeah, we could love to host it in the restaurant. And so we created a poster wall from that. And so, you know, I hope we will continue to evolve this. There will be more art going on the walls. There will be artists who design menus for us as a next step. So it's in process, really, I would say. You hope that it will just become a patina to the restaurant over time.
And that's all we've got time for this week's edition of The Curator. The show was produced by David Stevens and presented by me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again next week, and thank you for listening.